I'm going to ask you a question. Very simple question. What upset Jesus the most? The Pharisees and scribes and their attitude, or the lack of faith that was presented by the apostles from time to time, or by the disciples? The answer is really quite simple. It was the lack of faith. And the reason the lack of faith was such a problem to Jesus is because, well, let's look first of all. It's because in Hebrews 11, verse 6, if you just want to quickly turn to that, Hebrews 11, verse 6, we read, "Without faith, it is impossible to please him," that is God, "for he who comes for God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him." So, the reason Jesus would have had a problem with the disciples was from time to time, and as you go through the Gospels especially, you'll notice this, Jesus seemed to have a favourite word. "Oh ye of little faith. Oh you faithless generation." In other words, where is your faith? Why don't you believe? Now I thought, as this is a subject which was close to Jesus' heart, we'd look at it. But I immediately had a problem. And I'll tell you what the problem is. We go back a page here in my Bible. It's Hebrews 11, verse 1. Paul here is trying to describe faith to us. He's trying to give us an understanding of faith, of what it is. And he uses this terminology, which in English doesn't quite work for us. And I'll explain why. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. I remember when I was in Sunday school, that was one of the things we were taught. No, they would tell you what different things were, and they would give you an answer in the Bible. And we were going, "And what does that mean?" And do you know how many people could answer that question? None. Because they didn't know what it meant. But let's look for a moment and think, right? If you're going to say faith is a substance, what is a substance? A substance is something that you can get your hands on. It's something you can hold. This glass has in it a substance. It by itself can be called a substance because we can hold it. It's glass. But when we look at your faith, you can't measure it. Your faith isn't a substance in that sense. It's not something that you can take and analyze and look at and say, "Oh, I've got more than him," or "he's got more than me," or "she's got so much faith, I mean, she could lend me a bit." It doesn't work like that because it's not a substance. So the English word here, substance, doesn't really work. It's more confusing than helpful because we think of it differently. But having said that, Paul's still right about what he said here. It's just that the wording doesn't quite enlighten our understanding. So what I'd like to do for the rest of this sermon is actually look at what faith is. But not using old English, but modern English. And I'm not going to be going back into anywhere else in the scriptures other than the Gospels. So we're going to literally just be looking at what Jesus dealt with when he was dealing with faith. And we're going to look at a few individual examples, and we're going to talk about them examples. So I want to take you on a journey. So to start our little journey, I want to begin Mark 5 verse 22. If I got it wrong, no I haven't, I'm still okay. Here we go. There was a lady. But we're not starting with her. But we're going to come to her in a moment. There was a gentleman of his belonged, a ruler of the synagogue. His name was Jairus. Would you be happy enough with that pronunciation? Jairus. Okay. I have a job for you.
you are all going to become Jairus.
Okay? I want you to put yourself into Jairus' shoes, because we're going to look at things as he would have seen them as we go through this. And it's very important, because I want you to understand what's going on here. You're Jairus. Sadly, there is a problem happening in your family. Your daughter, who is 12, is ill. But it's not just the cold, the flu, or something like that. You know, and you've been reliably informed, that she's not going to survive. She's going to die. You're a person of great authority. You're highly respected. You're even rich. You have contacts all over the city. People listen to what you say. And yet, it's useless. Absolutely no good to you at all, because here's a problem outside your sphere of control. Nothing you can do about it. And then you hear, there is someone who's just come into your area. He's a traveling preacher, but he's got a reputation. And his reputation, if you hadn't had so many witnesses to hear about it, you would not have believed it yourself. He heals sick people. It don't matter what's wrong with them. The records say that he was healing people who had leprosy. He restored the sight to the blind. He makes the deaf hear. The lame walk. He restores limbs that have withered. And there's at least one reliable witness that says he even raised a dead person. You have that. He's in your town. There's a possibility he might come to your house and look at your daughter. There's only one thing working against you, and that's time. Because your daughter is very ill. So what do you do? Well, tell me what you did. You go and find him, don't you? You get yourself together. You get out of the house. And you start going to where he is. And it's not hard to find him. He's the one with the large crowd of people around him. And they're taking up all his time. They're really getting to know him. And they're asking him all sorts of things. And he's healing the sick left, right and centre by simply commanding and touching and gently telling them their faith has made them well. And you've listened to this for a few seconds and you've got through the crowd and people recognise who you are. I mean, you're dressed to impress. Do you understand? People know you. You carry an authority with you. So they're getting out of your way. And you come to this teacher and you say to him, quite humbly, because you really want him to work for you and you don't want to upset him at all. And so you're very humble when you approach him and you say, please, would you come to my house and heal my daughter, because she's on the verge of death. Now, you're not sure how he's going to take this. You're not sure if you've done it right. You're not sure what's going to happen. But you're overjoyed when he says, of course I will. That's not a problem. Let's go. You with me so far? We're happy. We understand the story. But then, as you're walking, he stops. There's no warning for him stopping. He just stops in his track. And he makes this ridiculous claim. He says, who touched me? And you're looking around and there's a massive multitude has been following you. And they're, you know, they're crowding and they're trying to get in and they're trying to move closer to him and they're trying to hear what he's saying to you and all the rest. And he's just stopped and he said, who touched me? And you're wondering, what's this about? Why does he need to know this? I mean, that's silly. My daughter is sick. Just come on to my house and we'll get this done. She's near death. But he doesn't. He stops. He's put you to one side for a moment and he's concentrating on whoever it was that touched him. Even his own disciples have come up to him and they've started saying to him, have you not noticed that we're kind of being mobbed here? And you're wondering who touched you? I mean, it's a bit silly.
Don't ask people who touched you. I mean, people have been banging into you all afternoon. I mean, you know this. He said, no, you misunderstand. Somebody actually received something from me because I felt the virtue go out of me. I know somebody has got healed. They've used faith. And he says again to the crowd, who touched me? Let's stop there for a moment. We're going to swap stories. We're going to look at it from somebody else's view. Again, I want you to take on a different person. I want you to be a lady. We're unsure of the age. But for the last 12 years, you've been suffering with a rather embarrassing problem, shall we say. And it's affecting your health in a rather strange ways. But it's affecting your social standing even more, because you're a Jewess. And because of this, you have spent all of your income, and you probably were quite rich at the time, but you weren't anymore because you've spent it all. You've given it all to every doctor and every physician about to try and get a cure for this ailment. And yet, you wasted your money. And you know that this rabbi who you're listening to has healed the sick. He has given sight to the blind. He's healed the deaf. He's raised the dead. He's done everything. And your problem's not really all that big when you look at it compared to some other people's problems. And that's how you've always looked at it. You don't see it as one of those big problems that needs to be centred. You see it as something that's an irritant to you and a problem. And you're embarrassed about it because the nature of the problem, according to the rituals of the law, would indicate that you should be separating yourself away from everybody. You shouldn't be in this big crowd. So you're not supposed to be there. That's the first part you have to think about. The second part is, this is a good man. He's a man of God. He's righteous. And you can see that. He's holy. You can see that too. And you're aware that if you actually touch him or get him to lay hands on you, you'll be making him unclean. And you're considering these things. How do I approach him and not reveal what I want healed of? How do I do that? How do I get round this problem? And you've been following him for a while. You've been looking at him and you've been close enough. But then it's dawned on you. From time to time, you've noticed that the hem of his garment hits the ground. And you know that anything that's hitting the ground is considered ritually unclean. But it's always been accepted among the Jews that the hem is ritually unclean. Therefore, when you would go into a person's house, the first thing they do is they offer to wash your feet so that you can clean yourself of the dirt of the street and become clean again. And the hem always sits that wee bit away from yourself because it's always going to hit the ground. And you're thinking to yourself, well now, me and that hem have something in common. And I think that if I was to touch the hem of that garment, of his garment, I could be made whole. I could be healed. And nobody would know about it. Nobody would even be aware that I had been unclean in the middle of this crowd. And that's what she had done. So here we have Jesus stopping, looking around, asking who this was. And here we have a lady aware that she's been healed, completely healed, totally healed. She's aware of it in herself. And because he seems to be making quite a commotion about it, she finally decides to step up and say, it was me. I did. And then she gave him the whole story. She explained every aspect of why she'd done it. Because she's worried. What if it goes away? What if he takes it away from me because of what I did? Because I didn't do it openly, because I didn't do it right. But he doesn't. He smiles. He gives her comfort and congratulates her on her faith and tells her that she is fully healed. Fully healed. You're back to being Jairus, aren't you? And you're still staying here. You've sat there. You've listened to all of that. You're aware of everything that's going on. And you know, the time has been going on a bit. It has been. It didn't happen in a minute. It didn't happen in 5 minutes. This took some time because first she had to be identified. She had to be brought through the crowd. She had to explain the whole thing. Jesus had to take time, explain things to her and talk to her and give her comfort. And all this takes time. And you've been sitting waiting, knowing that your daughter, and just as you're thinking about your daughter and you look out at the crowd towards your house, you see faces you don't really want to see. People from your house. And they're coming. They're coming to you. They're going to talk to you. Can you feel the dread starting to come into you? Can you feel the concern, the worry? Because you know, when they come to you, when they speak, it's not going to be good. And it's not good. For what they say to you is very simple. There's no point troubling the master anymore. The child is dead. Jairus, I want to ask you a question. Will you answer me? How do you feel about that? At that moment in time when that was told to you and you were aware of all that had just happened, how do you feel? You are fuming. Stupid woman. She could have waited, couldn't she? Why did you have to worry? Why did you have to trouble him? Why did you not wait until after he'd left my daughter? You know. But you know, all these thoughts never get an opportunity to manifest completely because you know what happens? Jesus overhears what Jairus has just been told. And he comes and he says to Jairus a very simple thing. Don't be afraid. Just believe. Don't be afraid. Just believe. We can look at that and we can say, well, what's he to believe in? Is he to believe in God? Of course he believes in God. He knows all about God. But that's not what Jesus was telling them. What he was telling them was, just believe me. Believe that your child will be okay. Because I am telling you, your child will be okay. And there you have a situation. You've just got the word, your child is dead. You know that the people telling you don't make mistakes lightly. It's not something that they get wrong. And yet you've just been told by a relative stranger who you've been seeking out, I agree, but a relative stranger, nevertheless, not to worry about it. Trust them. You're Jairus. What's going through your head? How do you feel about that? Are you going to listen to the servants and friends that have come to tell you the bad news? Or this individual who you've seen work miracles, but you don't know anything about other than that? Who are you going to believe? Jairus made a choice, and that choice was to believe Jesus. It was all he did. No substance, nothing extra. He simply made a choice. I am going to believe him and not them. We know the story. They went on to the house, the whole crowd still with them. And when they got to the house, there's a bigger crowd almost there. Because this is a very popular man. This family's known all over the land. And the fact that the daughter has died meant that professional mourners and everything has been brought in. The whole process is in full swing. Preparing the body, getting ready. All of this has started already. Because they don't exactly delay. It all has to be done in a day. So it's all activity. And when Jesus walks in with them, the first thing he says is, what are you so mourning about? What's going on? The child's not dead, she's only asleep. Well, you can know how that went down, don't you? I mean, can you imagine walking into the undertaker after he has prepared the body? That's not what happened here, but can you imagine? And somebody saying to you, that's all right, no, don't worry, they're only asleep, I'm going to wake them up now. You have the evidence that death happened in that house. You have the evidence. All the people there knew. Not thought, not considered, not might have been mistaken. They knew the child was dead. They'd seen it before. They understood the principles. There wasn't an ounce of hope left in that household until Jesus walked in and said, she's not dead, she's asleep. But they couldn't believe that. So what did he do? Threw them out, said, get them out of here. And he did. He moved them all out. He just kept Jairus, Jairus' wife, and a few of the disciples. And they went up to the girl, and disciples, the moment they saw the girl, they didn't have a question. They agreed with everybody outside. She's dead. Yep, you can tell it. She's that colour of death. She's not moving, and she's ice cold. She's dead. Definitely dead. No doubt about it. Jesus ignores them. What would they know? He walks up, says, little girl, get up. And there, just before them all, she just gets up. He gives her to her parents and says to them, feed her, she's hungry. That story, in all its detail, is recorded in three Gospels. You will find it in Mark 17, starting in 14 to 21. You'll find it in Luke 8, verse 41 to 56, Matthew 9, 18 to 26, and Mark 5, 22 to 43. It's that important, that story. And each gospel gives us a little more information about it. So you can check them out, you can look and see. But the faith shown by both the lady and by Jairus wasn't something that we can measure. In fact, it only mounts up to one thing. They believed. That's all it was. In Jairus' situation, he believed what Jesus told him. He believed Jesus. The lady, she simply believed that if she touched the hem of that garment, she could be healed. Because she'd worked everything else out. She had put herself into a situation she couldn't come to him herself. It wouldn't have been right. It wouldn't have been proper. But if she could touch the hem, and it was given to her for her faith. Okay, we saw success. A successful healing through faith. Let's look at another one. This time we will go to Matthew. No, I'll go to Mark 9, verses 14 to 29. Mark 9, 14 to 29, because I'm sitting here in the book of Mark. But the story itself is again in three Gospels. Jesus had just spent a night on a mountain with a few of the disciples where they had saw a most remarkable vision. Jesus glorified. And now as they were coming down from the mountain, the rest of the disciples were out and about doing what they were supposed to be doing, which was working with the multitude, healing the sick, casting out devils, comforting and teaching about the kingdom of God. Because Jesus was away, they filled the gap. That was their job. That's what they were doing. They had the authority to do that. So, when Jesus is coming, he notices there's a problem. Some of the scribes have started a discussion. Well, it's more like an argument. They were stating very directly that the disciples couldn't possibly have had authority to cast out devils. Because they often said it then. And to prove the point, prove the point,
a gentleman had already brought a child who had an evil spirit in them, and it was still in them. It hadn't went out. The disciples had done everything they had done before, but the spirit remained unmoved, unresponsive. Everything was at a status quo. And the man, who was the father of the child, was in a terrible state. Because he knew that if you brought somebody who was sick, no matter what was wrong with them, to this group, they were healed. There never was a failure. None was recorded. Everybody got healed. Everybody got released from whatever burden there was upon them. And yet, his son still had the spirit. No healing. And the scribes had taken on to this greatly. Oh, they were having a field day. And the dispute was going on between them and the apostles or the disciples in relation to this. They were saying, see that, it only proves if you had the authority of God, if it was real, then you should have been able to do this, but you just couldn't do it. And if you just can't do it once, you probably couldn't do it at any time. It was luck before. And they were busy doing this. And the disciples were still saying, no, 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 we have the permission. We were given the permission. And they were speaking, and nothing's happening. Jesus comes onto this scene, and this is what's happening. And he says, what's going on here? What are you disputing with the disciples about? And what's happening? And immediately, the man from the crowd comes up and says, I brought my son to your disciples because he's been troubled by a spirit. The spirit makes him go into seizures, and it throws him into the fire and into water and is trying to kill him. And I knew that this spirit needs to be cast out, so I brought them to him to get it cast out, but they couldn't do it. And then the man looks up to Jesus and says, can you do something? You can feel this man's pain. You can feel his anguish, can't you? Can you do something? Jesus responded very directly, do you think I can do something? Do you think I can do it? And the man says, I don't know. I really don't know. It's read in your Bible, I have faith, but help my unbelief. I want to believe, but help my unbelief. He says, I don't know. I've seen them try, but I haven't seen the result. And Jesus says, oh, evil and perverse generation, faithless ones. And he calls the boy to come to him. And as the child is coming, demon fires him into the fits. Jesus stops and looks at this for a moment and says, how long has he been at this? Since childhood. Okay. And with a quick command, the spirit is gone. But there's a problem. The boy isn't moving. He isn't breathing. There is no signs of life whatsoever. The demon has seemed to have succeeded. Oh yes, Jesus sent it out, but he is dead. Everyone can see it. But you see, Jesus doesn't consider that a problem. He just goes up, lifts the boy by the hand, tells him to get up, and restores life to him. Because he can. And faith is restored. But you know, it's troubling the disciples. They can't have that. I mean, if we go out, the disciples are saying to Jesus, and this happens again when you're not about, what do we do? Why would that spirit not have gone out for us? What was going on? How did it not work when it worked every other time? Did God just not listen to us or what? And Jesus said to them, No, it's because you didn't have enough faith.
Again, we forget this idea that faith is a substance. So let's drop that word. Let's change the word slightly. No, it's because you didn't believe. You didn't trust God enough. You felt that the authority that had been given to you, there was a doubt about because of the scribes and what their argument with you was. They were telling you the authority couldn't be right. And then, because you accepted what they were saying as right, even though you knew you had the authority, it created a doubt in your mind. And as a result of that doubt, rendered your faith useless. And that's why the Spirit couldn't be moved. This kind you have to have full faith with. You have to understand that the authority given to you is to speak and it will be done. And there is no other option. It's very black and white. That's why Jesus said, this kind needs prayer. It needs you to be almost as if you were fasting. Sometimes fasting's good. Though you'll notice that where this comes up, the fasting actually has a wee mark beside it, because it's not in the original. It's only in certain Bibles. So they've put it in, but they put a wee mark beside it. But the prayer bit's in. And the reason for that is, you've got to believe. You've got to believe. Okay, so we've seen healings and faith that have been very successful, and we've seen ones that just seem to get pulled out of the fire by Jesus at the last minute because things can go wrong. But did Jesus ever have any problems with them? Did he ever experience any problems when it comes to laying hands on anyone? I only could find one. It's recorded in Mark 8 verses 22 to 26. And it's outside Israel a wee bit. It's in one of the Gentile places. And the people of that town bring a blind man to Jesus. They present him before them. And Jesus doesn't heal him immediately. He says, let's take him out of the town, away from these people. So he separates the man away from the people. And when he's alone with his disciples and this man, Jesus takes a bit of clay, mixes it up with a bit of spittle, and puts it on the man's eyes. He then washes it off and says to the man, what do you see? And the man looks, and he says, I see men like trees. Now, what did Jesus do? Did he say, well, at least you can see? See, the Spirit of God is work. It'll work. It'll take time, but you'll get yourself back. Did he do that? No. He didn't. Because that's not how God works. God does not do things by little bits. It's complete or not at all.
Amen.
So the whole point is, Jesus went again. He got a little more clay. He put a bit more spittle. He put it back in the man's eyes, and he washed it off. And he says, now what do you see? I see perfect. And he says, don't go back to that town. Don't go near that town. Go home. But what happened? What actually happened? Why was the man not healed the first time? Do you think maybe Jesus doubted? That would be ludicrous. Of course he didn't doubt. But look at the whole way this has happened. These people in this town weren't there when this man was healed. But they had brought the man to Jesus. So let's understand what this was about. These people wanted to see a miracle. So they had simply got a blind man and said, let's bring him and see what he does with him. But Jesus didn't do the miracle for them. He didn't do it there. He says, no. Take that man and bring him out of the city and keep him out there. So he took him away, out of the city. And then he went out to where the man was. Then he went through the process. And his disciples are watching this, and they're quite amazed. Why didn't he heal him at the time? What was going on here? But there was a reason why Jesus didn't do it, and it was very simple. The only reason that town wanted this man healed was to see a spectacle. They wanted to see a show.
They want to understand how this would work. Could he actually heal in their town?
Jesus didn't give them a show. He did it in private.
But you see, the man himself also had a problem, because he was part and parcel of this. Yes, he was taken aside, and yes, he was getting his sight back, but he wasn't sure if Jesus could do it. He didn't know who Jesus was, other than that he was this travelling Jew. This was not a Jewish man. This was a Gentile. And yet this Gentile who was given to him was subject to this blindness. Now, because this is a Gentile, Jesus didn't say, eyes open. He didn't say, your sight is received. He'd done this everywhere else, but he didn't do it here. He actually went, got a bit of clay, mixed it up, put it in the man's eyes. I mean, Jesus doesn't do that. Check your Bibles. That's not how he normally worked. So why did he do it here? It was because this man couldn't have believed. He couldn't accept that someone just speaking to him could have given him his eyes. But if there was a ritual to it, then it might work, because he could understand the principle of magics. You know, cures and charms and different things like that. He could understand that. So in order to restore his sight, Jesus worked within his understanding and give him the clay. Jesus didn't need the clay. It was there for the man's benefit. So why didn't the eyes open the first time? That was to help the disciples. How does that help the disciples? Simple. The disciples had a problem. They felt that if God didn't heal completely, then it couldn't be from God. Right? They felt that if a person only received partially a healing, then it couldn't be from God, and therefore rejected the whole thing. And Jesus wanted them to understand that that's not how it works. A person's faith is what determines how much of the healing they're able to receive at a time. Now, I grant you, when Jesus was healing, they were healed completely, totally. But he wanted to explain something to them, that they were going to meet people who couldn't accept a full healing. They wouldn't accept a full healing because they felt that it was right for them to have pains, suffering and problems. And it took the church a long time to realize that. But this is what Jesus was trying to show them. And this man who was blind felt that he should be blind. He felt it was right. He felt this was how he was born, this was how he was brought up, this was the way it was meant to be. He himself hadn't come to be made and given sight. He'd been made to do it by the people of the town. Do you understand the difference? Subtle, but there, just the same. But Jesus healed him completely, totally, and all the rest. Now you might say, well, he used this means for this blind man, did he use it anywhere else? Yes. In another Gentile town, he spit and put his fingers in somebody's ears to restore their sight, because they needed the ritual. They needed that to believe. So you see, faith's like that. Faith, at the end of the day, boils down to one thing. Do we believe Jesus? That's it. We don't need to measure it, we don't need to worry about it or anything else. It's just, how much do you believe Jesus? Because if you believe him, he says, whatever is required is done. Whatever you ask is given. Whatever you say will happen. If you had a grain of mustard seed, I'm making a big mustard seed, say. That's just so just going to say it. But if you had a grain of a mustard seed, then you would be able to do anything. That means, in simple English, if you could believe God, if you believed what Jesus said in the smallest amount, I mean really believe him, you're unlimitable. The kingdom of God works through you, and you can do anything and everything in and through Jesus Christ. And that is what has been given to you individually. Earlier on, John mentioned that one person can make a difference. And he gave us a few examples that one vote in America allows us to speak English, or allowed them to speak English. I can't help thinking, if it was German, think of the TV we'd have been saved. But then again, one vote also put Hitler in charge. Again, that's these things doing. But with us, we don't need to vote. It's one person believing God. Just one makes a difference. One. Because their trust of God, their belief in God, their willingness to accept that God said it, that's true, is all that's needed to generate and help everyone else's faith and belief.